The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although New Hampshire's first in the nation primary is still months away, the invisible primary is in full swing, and many votes have already been cast.
I'm here today to endorse my friend Hillary Clinton for president.
That is Jean Shaheen officially endorsing Hillary Clinton, one of several Democrats supporting Hillary. Just how important are these political endorsements, and who is leading the invisible primary? Well, Aaron Bykoff is meticulously tracking the endorsements for each candidate for the 538 blog, and he's got some ideas for us. Aaron Bykoff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's lay down the ground rules. Not all endorsements are created equally. Tell us what your point system is.
Right. So our point system is that U.S. representatives count for 1 point, U.S. senators count for 5 points, and governors count for 10 points. This is based on a point system used in a book called The Party Decides, which is kind of the basis for a lot of the theory around the importance of endorsements.
So who's in the lead for endorsements?
Well, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is the very clear leader and has been for some time. We started looking at this at a year out from Iowa. At that point, she had about as many endorsement points as Bill Clinton had on the day of Iowa in 1992. So she was the clear leader going in. She has continued to build on that lead. Every few days, it seems, there's someone new endorsing her. Her next closest rival, Bernie Sanders, only has 2 endorsement points.
And how many has Hillary got at this point?
Hillary has 391.
So why would she have a clear lead, 391 to 2? What about on the Republican side?
On the Republican side, things are much different. It's been a much slower buildup. When we started tracking this, Jeb Bush was in the lead. He continues to be in the lead, but it's a much closer race. He has 37 points. Next is Chris Christie with 25 points. Marco Rubio is at 13 points. There are a few other candidates in between them, but he has picked up 3 new endorsements in the past 2 weeks.
Yet those on the top of the polls, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, have yet to receive an endorsement publicly from any politician. Bernie Sanders has only 2, you mentioned. Do these endorsements actually influence voters?
Well, in the past, they have in a lot of cases. You know, voters tend to not pay attention, as close attention this early in the race, though, of course, in New Hampshire and Iowa, things are a bit different. But voters look to party officials to help them make their choice as to who to support. In the book I mentioned earlier, The Party Decides, the authors found that for each increase in the share of endorsements of 10 percentage points to a candidate, their share of delegates won in the primaries goes up about 8%. Hmm. So there is definitely a relationship. Now, it's not foolproof, like we mentioned, and there have been cases where the candidate who is supported earlier by more party officials does not end up getting the nomination.
What would be an example of that?
So in 2008, Hillary Clinton was the endorsement leader until about halfway through the primaries. And then once it became clear that Obama was on the verge of winning and had a clear path to winning the nomination, her endorsements leveled out. His increased just before he won the nomination. A lot of the people who had been sitting on the sidelines decided to endorse him. Mm-hmm. So in the end, the party leaders coalesced around him. It just took much longer.
I wonder if it's seen as much of a coup to get endorsements now, specifically when in a year in an election cycle, when being the anti-establishment candidate, you know, one that is not favored by Washington, is seen as a plus?
Right. That's a fair point. And I think on the Republican side, that is one of the reasons perhaps that things are going a little more slowly. But candidates are still very proud when they do get one of these endorsements. So in their eyes, it's important. We'll just have to see whether this cycle really is different.
How important is the timing of an endorsement? Better to get them early before the primaries?
Yeah, I think early is usually what the candidates would want and what would benefit them the most. I mean, at this point, for example, if Marco Rubio were to come out tomorrow with 10 new endorsements, that would be a pretty clear sign that at least part of the leadership of the party that whose nomination he's trying to win supports him. If they come out, you know, one at a time over the next 3 months, every few days, that's more of a trickle and less clear of a, like I said, less clear that the party is coalescing around him.
So there is clearly a benefit for the recipient of an endorsement. What's in it for the endorser?
Well, if their chosen candidate wins, they can say that they were in that person's camp early on. It may mean some preferable speaking role, or it may mean that the candidate then helps the endorser campaign later on. It could mean a few different things, but I think more than anything, it's just that endorser having a say in who ends up getting the nomination and being able to tell their constituents that they were on the side of the person who won.
Aaron Bykoff, thanks so much for giving us a peek into this invisible endorsement primary.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me.
Aaron Bykoff, he's a computational journalist for Nate Silver's 538 blog, and he's been keeping track of political endorsements of each of the presidential candidates. And of course, because it is the 538 blog, great graphs, great things to look at, and you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1967, at the height of his success, one of the world's great singer-songwriters, Jacques Brel, stopped singing. "I left the day I realized I had an ounce of talent," he later said. "I stopped singing for honest reasons, not for reasons of exhaustion." The following year, two New Yorkers put together a musical review of Brel's work to remind the world that even though the great chanteur had retired, he was not dead. Early reviews of Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, which premiered at the Village Gate in 1968, were overwhelmingly terrible. The New York Times panned it, and the show's creators, Eric Blau and Mort Schumann, nearly shut it down. But their main backer, Hank Hoffman, loved the show too much to let it die. He promised to finance it for a full year, even if he lost his shirt. Well, he didn't. And 47 years later, Jacques Brel is alive and well. The musical is itself alive and well. As Sean Hurley tells us, the show is coming for two nights only to Fireworks in Keene, New Hampshire. That's a restaurant owned by Matt Blau, son of the show's co-creator and star.
When Matt Blau was 5 years old, his parents took him to the Village Gate, a showbiz nightclub in Greenwich Village. Their new musical, Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, had just opened, and they wanted to show their son where they worked and what they did. His father, Eric, had co-created the review with Mort Schumann, translating Brel's intricate French lyrics into something both new and true to the original. Matt sat on his father's lap and watched his mother, Ellie Stone, alone on stage, singing a song he'd only ever heard her sing at home.
Sons of the thief, sons of the saint, who is the child with no complaint?
Strangely, or not so strangely, as the result of what they did and who they were, I didn't really have much of a childhood because they weren't around, they weren't home a lot.
For the next 5 years, from the ages of 5 to 10, Blau was either at home alone or at the show himself.
So I was the sort of little mascot. Back then, there weren't a lot of 7-year-olds running around the Village Gate 3 times or 4 times a week. And so that's where the really beautiful part of it happens in my memory.
There was the magic of the basement club itself, and there was the growing glamour of his parents' fame.
And then there's the show itself, which even at that age, for me, was incredibly beautiful. It really is the soundtrack to my childhood. And I think even with being too young to really understand what much of it meant, I got the power of it.
Here's Blau's mother, Ellie Stone, singing Madeline.
I loved all games and fairy tales, as strangely odd as that may seem.
I think I liked the male songs more. My mother's singing was gorgeous, and her songs were gorgeous, but I would hear them all the time, and I'd hear her voice all the time. And, you know, you get jaded to that a little bit, but the men were powerful and big, and their songs were strong, and I didn't get to hear that a lot.
Here's one of Blau's favorites, Jackie, as sung by Mort Schumann.
And if one day I should become a singer with a Spanish bum who sings for women of great virtue, I'd sing to them with a guitar I borrowed from a coffee bar. Well, what you don't know doesn't hurt you.
It was never my mother's song, although I listen to them now and I can't keep the tears back.
Lau is 52 years old now and lives in Brattleboro. His father died a few years ago, but he speaks to his mother almost daily. He owns three restaurants, Fireworks in Brattleboro in Vermont, and Fireworks in Keene, New Hampshire. He can't sing, he says, or act, but he's always wanted to mix what he does now with what his parents did then.
I've always wanted to use the restaurant as a venue for something that I loved, something musical, and I've always wanted to bring this music back. I'm not sure that I ever put the two together.
Until he met David Stern. Stern is 52. He's the artistic director at Main Street Arts in Saxton's River, Vermont. And he grew up listening to a particular record, the original cast recording of Jacques Brel as Alive and Well and Living in Paris. And one day, as Stern recollects, the two men bumped into each other.
And we started talking about Brel because I just mentioned that his name and the author's last name, which are not common, were the same. And it was his dad, and his mom was a singer that I'd grown up listening to, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to perform it at one of his restaurants?
And immediately, he had this idea, why don't we do it at Fireworks?
Stern put a cast together, and 6 weeks later, invited Blau and his daughter Lila to see a rehearsal.
The thing is, it's a difficult show to do. It's one of the more difficult shows to do. And the reason that it's difficult to do is that you have to more not do it than do it. So the essential thing in Brel is really to get out of the way of it.
I think the way we've tried to do it is to pay real homage to that initial spirit, to sing with a full heart. It's not about technique for us, or the technique that it is about the technique of opening your soul and your spirit so other people can see their own.
Here's Allie McKay singing Old Folks in Stern's revival.
The old folks don't talk much, and they talk so slowly when they do. They are rich, they are poor, their illusions are gone, they share one heart.
This weekend at Fireworks in Keene, Matt Blau will sit down with his own daughter at his own restaurant and hear the English version of the songs his parents made famous.
It's something that I have been systematically introducing to my own daughter, who is 8, and we listen to this, and she says, "Daddy's crying again."
Here's Julie Olson singing Sons Of in the new production.
Sons of the thief, sons of the saint.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Who is a child with no complaint.
Well, Jacques Brel will be alive and well and living in Keene, New Hampshire for just this weekend. You can find more on the show at Fireworks at wordofmouthradio.org.
Children like your own, the same.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About 700 climbers are expected to ascend Mount Everest during its annual climbing season. Well, you may have heard about the mounting trash and oxygen tanks and other equipment discarded by mountaineers at base camp, climber Brent Bishop is on a tear about the decades worth of human feces left behind on the mountain considered to be the roof of the world. In an article for Outside Online, he asks, has Mount Everest reached peak poop? And Brent Bishop is a veteran climber and a businessman. Brent, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you.
You've climbed Everest several times. Why is it getting worse? Is it the sheer volume of the climbers, or you think the attitude?
Well, I think the issue with fecal material on Everest really boils down to the number of people on the mountain during the climbing season and the fact that people are generally lazy and there's no infrastructure or regulation on the mountain at this point.
Well, I'm wondering, I would think, you know, you go to the bathroom on the mountainside, it biodegrades. Does that not happen? Does it freeze at that altitude?
Well, with that many people, it freezes, but it really doesn't go away. You know, if people dig little latrines into the snow or into the glacier area, it ends up melting out. So it's, in essence, it's a ticking time bomb. And also, you know, in the past, people would dispose of fecal material in crevasses, but they're finding that the material eventually comes out, depending on where it's put in, and that the material is not inert, so it affects water supply, and it can get airborne and cause upper respiratory issues. So it's not just unsightly, but there are a lot of health issues associated with the amount of human waste on the mountain.
What are climbers supposed to do with their own waste?
Well, you know, in a perfect world, you pack out what you pack in, right? So there's technology available. There are these things called WAG bags, which are basically a glorified bag that you can use for fecal material. And that type of system, along with some sort of portable latrines, if you will, are being used on places like Denali to great effect and Aconcagua, the tallest mountain in South America, which sees 6,000 visitors a year. And really the difference is that the Park Service there mandates that this type of technology is used. And the issue with Nepal, at least above base camp, there are no rules or regulations in place that mandate that people are responsible.
I also, you know, think about conditions on Mount Everest. We're told that they're so perilous, you know, that people are so concerned about their safety. There's this idea that, well, that's the last thing that they're worrying about.
Well, that, you know, that's a misconception. I mean, there are times where it's perilous and you've got to be concerned about safety first and foremost, but you know, they're no different than climbing Denali or Aconcagua or Mount Vincent in the Antarctic. Most of mountaineering is just about kind of work and suffering and waiting around. And so there's no reason that that should be used as an excuse. I mean, it really boils down to that people are lazy. And you know, another issue is that the Nepalese government and the Ministry of Tourism is ineffective. I mean, it's you know, most of the money that goes to the peak fees, I mean, every climber now is paying $11,000 just for a peak fee, right? Mm. And none of that money really makes it back up to the mountain.
And that's not even the cost of a Sherpa, which I guess have been assigned to, at least in some cases, haul trash from the climbers.
Right. I mean, Sherpas, you know, most expeditions are actually very responsible with their trash. And the Ministry of Tourism mandates that you bring back all your trash. And in fact, you have to leave an environmental deposit of $4,000 for an expedition, and you get it back when you return to base camp. But, you know, attitudes have changed, and I really don't see climbers acting the way they did 2-3 decades ago. So the trash issue is addressed. Now, you know, the next thing that has to be addressed is the fecal waste above base camp. At base camp, you know, people use basically these portable toilets, these blue barrels, if you will, that are made into toilets. And that waste, it's mandated that it's hauled down and disposed of below base camp. So the base camp waste issue is addressed for the most part, but it's up high on the mountain where Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, and Camp 4, which is the last camp at 8,000 meters or 26,000 feet, where, you know, everywhere you look, there seems to be, you know, human waste.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that on Mount McKinley, the highest peak in North America, and in Aconcagua in South America, highest peak, They're working on systems. What would it take to make similar systems and regulation work on Everest?
Well, it'll take education, and it'll take some type of, you know, rules and regulations that are enforced. You know, people just have to be willing to roll their sleeves up and just do a little bit more work or a little bit more effort, which, you know, if you're going to, you know, be in the throne room of the mountain gods, you know, which is really what Everest is, you know, you should treat it with respect. And not taking care of your human waste, it doesn't seem very respectful to me. Now, that said, I know a number of guide services that, you know, have been packing out all their human waste, right? They've been taking these smaller toilets up higher on the mountain. They've been using these wag bags. They've been educating their climbers and the Sherpas that are helping them climb, and they've had great success. So, you know, the fact is, you know, everybody else needs to follow suit and get with the program. You know, what's nice about this problem is that, you know, there's no secret technology. It's not going to cost really very much money. It's just about doing the right thing, which, you know, when you look at most environmental issues, it boils down to that.
Brent Bishop, thank you for speaking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Brent Bishop is a mountain climber and a businessman, and he wrote Peak Poop, The Feces Problem on Everest Needs a Solution, that was posted on Outside Online. You can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Marketing is often about selling the experience that surrounds a product, just as much as selling the product itself. As when Chili's began selling the sizzle of their fajitas. Roman Mars is host of the podcast 99% Invisible, exposing the things that we don't necessarily see. And he brings us this story.
It's really hard to get a sound trademarked. The first one in the U.S. was issued in 1978 to NBC for their chimes.
MGM has one for their roaring lion, as does 20th Century Fox.
That's 99PI's own Katie Mingle, TM.
Harley-Davidson famously tried to trademark the sound of their motorcycles, that potato, potato, potato sound.
After years of litigation, they finally withdrew their application. So if a bunch of burly bikers can't do it, it must be really hard.
Right now, there are fewer than 200 active trademarks for sounds, even though sound can be super important to brand. Just ask these guys.
My name is Joel Beckerman.
And I'm Tyler Gray.
Tyler and I wrote a book called The Sonic Boom, How Sound Transforms the Way We Think, Feel, and Buy.
Here's a sound that would be, like, impossible to trademark. But Tyler and Joel say it was crucial to building up the brand it's associated with.
Steak and shrimp fajita. Very careful, really hot.
Oh man, I know that sound. I know it so well. When I was just a little kid on a cul-de-sac, they built a Chili's in my town. This was before there were really chain restaurants where I lived, so Chili's actually felt kind of novel and exotic. My family was pumped, and our favorite thing to order? The fajitas.
They don't really sell the steak, they sell the sizzle.
In their book, Joel and Tyler use Chili's and their sizzling fajitas as an opening example to illustrate why companies should think more about sound.
You're sitting in a Chili's at the dinner hour at 5 o'clock, and let's say at first nobody's ordering the sizzling fajitas, but then maybe about 20 minutes, 30 minutes into the dinner hour, and I've seen this, all of a sudden one person orders sizzling fajitas.
As the server brings out the sizzling skillet of fajita meat and onions.
And you hear that sizzling sound, literally every eye, every single person in that restaurant, their head turns to the server walking past them, and they follow that server with their eyes, and then they smell the burnt onions and that whole, and now you're hooked. And now everyone orders the sizzling fajitas. And in the back, instead of making that one order, they make 15.
Yeah, they call it the fajita effect.
My family fell victim to the fajita effect too many times to remember. We may even have initiated the original fajita effect, patient zero of the fajita effect.
Chili's, by the way, did not invent the fajita. That distinction goes to a Texan by the name of Sonny Falcone. He was selling a subpar cut of meat called the faja and figured that if you cooked it out in the open with a lot of spice, people didn't care about the quality of the meat.
It got to Chili's because
Larry Levine was the founder of Chili's,
had seen restaurants around the Rio Grande Valley sort of do their version of it. He had the idea to make sound the star of the show. And so when Chili's opened up, they put that sound of sizzling fajitas in their first ever commercial.
Fajitas sold like crazy. In the wake of their massive success, Chili's printed up t-shirts for staff that said, "I survived the summer of fajita madness."
Now they serve enough fajita meat to fill 2 nuclear submarines a year.
I really hope someone filled 2 nuclear submarines with fajita meat to get that measurement.
Tyler and Joel say it's surprisingly difficult to get people, even really creative people, to think about sound, to value it in the same way they value the visual environment.
But sometimes there's one person who gets it. At Apple Computers, one of those people was a guy by the name of Jim Reeks.
Hi, my name is Jim Reeks. I am the only person you know whose name is a complete sentence.
Jim worked at Apple for about 10 years, starting in the late 80s.
We didn't really have titles. I don't even think I had business cards.
Well, whatever his title was, Jim was working on sound for the Macintosh computers.
Which was a neglected stepchild of all things Mac. No one really cared about the sound until the end, which is unfortunately typical.
Except Jim. He's a composer and a musician, and he understood the importance of sound more than most of his colleagues. And Jim had strong feelings about the startup sound that was on the Mac at the time.
I just hated it. I just could not stand it.
Here's what it sounded like. Here it is a couple more times because it goes by really fast.
So when Apple first started up, it was, the computer was far from perfect. It crashed a lot.
And every time you turned it back on, you heard that jolting sound. So Jim set out to make a better one.
Your Mac just crashed again. You've lost your work again. You're waiting for this thing to boot up again. That's the audience. Just a bunch of pissed off, frustrated people who are super annoyed and you're wasting their time.
That's a hard audience to play to.
I gotta change everyone's mood. So I was thinking a zen-like meditative sound similar to a gong or chanting om.
Of course, we're all familiar with the sound he came up with.
Oh, that's nice.
So much better, right? Only problem was Jim asked for permission to put this new sound into the prototype for the new Mac, and
I was told I couldn't do it. We already have a sound. You're not allowed to change it. It was just on and on and on.
But Jim knew the people who were responsible for building the prototype.
I played it for them, and then they liked it. And so when no one was around, we put it into the build.
And the Quadra 700 shipped with the sound in it.
That was back in 1991, when the Quadra 700 Mac cost $6,000. Jim says he never got any props for the sound, just grief. And yet, that sound, with a few minor tweaks, has been the Apple startup sound ever since.
So I think we can assume that Steve Jobs liked it.
It's this big, giant, two-handed C chord, C major chord, that makes you kind of feel welcome to this very stable, very substantial world of Apple. It's probably the single most connected sound with the Apple brand.
And brand is just the experience or a perception prior to the experience. So everything that shapes the perception matters. It would be, like imagine a really beautiful car that just had this horrible engine always backfiring.
Actually, there are people who make sure that beautiful cars sound beautiful, or at least that they sound right. One of them is Sean Carney.
Hi, my name is Sean Carney. I'm the Mustang powertrain sound quality engineer for Ford.
Sean works on Mustangs, and there are all kinds of things he and his team can tweak to get the sound they're looking for.
There's different tubes inside that the exhaust gases will flow through, and those tubes have different shapes and different perforations in them. They have different hole patterns in them. It's sort of like an instrument.
Kind of like you can control the sound of a horn by placing your fingers over different holes, Sean can control the sound of the Mustang. And it's an easier job for the standard V8. But then sometimes they'll put out a specialty Mustang.
In 2008, Mustang decided to put out a remake of a Mustang that appeared in the movie Bullet in 1968. In the movie, there's a pretty famous chase sequence where Steve McQueen drives his Mustang all over the streets of San Francisco.
Sean and his team wanted to make the 2008 Bullet sound similar to the 1968 Bullet.
So when it comes to a car like a Bullet, it's about an old car from an old movie. So yeah, we're trying to make that specific car speak to you in a way of it's drawing you back into those old memories. It's almost like that folklore of what that car might have been.
They're trying essentially to make a new car sound old, which is challenging because cars made in 1968 were built completely differently.
That old engine had a carburetor. We use a fuel injection system, and all those things they completely change how the engine can sound.
Sean was never going to be able to duplicate the sound of the Bullet car from the movie exactly. For one, the Mustang in the movie was enhanced with sounds recorded from a race car. And apart from that, it's actually illegal in most places to drive around in a car that loud.
So a big part of what we try to do is we try to identify, what are those key characteristics, like what are the notes that are being played by that classic American V8 sound that's in the movie.
When the reviews of the Bullet Mustang came out, people talked about the sound, and most people thought Sean and his team had gotten it right. Here's the 2008 Bullet Mustang in action.
Sound is actually, in terms of all of our senses, it's the one we react to quickest. It's even quicker than touch.
That's Joel Beckerman again.
Brands that are not paying attention to this, not paying attention to sound in association with experiences, they're really going to get punished.
Case in point, in 2010, Frito-Lay decided to come out with a new biodegradable Sun Chips bag.
Only problem was they never considered what that packaging sounded like.
Here's a YouTube video someone made about the bag.
Delicious Sun Chips, love all your products. Thing that I cannot get over is the noise that this bag makes. I don't know what it's made out of. If you ever wanted to get like just one little chip out of the bag, I'm actually yelling and you probably can't hear me. If you want to get one chip out of this bag, good luck.
That guy on YouTube was not the only person to notice how noisy the bag was.
Someone created a Facebook page called Sorry I Can't Hear You Over This Sun Chips Bag, and it got 40,000 likes, and it became a national news story.
They had to pull the new bag and go back to the old bag. Good intentions, bad execution.
Joel and Tyler refer to this kind of sound as sonic trash.
You know, you'd never let somebody take a bunch of trash and throw it in your front lawn, but we allow cities, our neighbors, brands, to really invade our sonic space.
They dump garbage in your ear? Is that what
essentially,
you're saying?
Essentially.
Joel and Tyler imagine a world where all the sounds we hear have more thought behind them, more intention.
It would be very rare that you would actually hear the sound that something made. That thing would trigger a better sound.
In Tyler's world, they could make the Sun Chips bag sound like this when it's opened. Every time you get a chip, you're like, la.
Yeah, except that sound. It's actually on that very short list of trademark sounds. So hands off.
Whatever.
And that story was produced by Roman Mars for the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After George Washington developed a sore throat in the winter of 1799, doctors decided the best course of treatment would be bloodletting. Washington died within a day. History is littered with stories of bizarre cures and botched treatments, and frequent bloodlettings are among them. Bloodletting was thought to release bad humors and cure patients of ailments caused by too much blood, like fevers and headaches. Although it largely disappeared from Western medicine by the 20th century, bloodletting is alive and well in some parts of the world, and a handful of studies suggest there might be something to it. Erika Engelhaupt is online science editor for National Geographic, where she wrote about the contemporary practice of this seemingly medieval treatment. Erika, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So how long has bloodletting as medical treatment been around?
Probably for at least 3,000 years. It goes all the way back to the Egyptians, and you find people writing about bloodletting all around the world throughout history.
And when did it stop being used?
Well, it really kind of died a slow death, actually. It's still being used in some cases around the world today, but it really started to die out during the 1800s. And it was after some notable incidents of bloodletting gone awry. For example, in 1793, there was a yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia, and a doctor who was a big believer at the time in bloodletting, Benjamin Rush, incidentally, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, he began a real campaign to use bloodletting to try to cure people of this this infection. And in fact, it probably wasn't working quite very well at all. And there are reports that, you know, they were dumping so much blood outside his home that you could actually see flies and smell the blood. In some cases, they were really draining fairly large amounts of blood, much more than what you would do, say, if you were donating blood today.
Yeah.
And that can be quite dangerous when you're taking a lot of blood. George Washington, who you mentioned, it's thought that he had at least 40% of his blood drained within a day when he came down sick. And it's hard to know exactly what killed him in the end. It was probably a combination of things, but certainly having that much of his blood drained out in that short of a period of time did not help.
So when did people come around to knowing that this probably wasn't a good idea?
Well, it was really when you started to have a backlash against some of these incidents, like the yellow fever outbreak. And some doctors started to say, wait, we need to look at this in a more scientific manner. You had a doctor named Pierre Louis. He's considered to be the founder of medical statistics. And he began to talk to doctors and try to convince them that they needed to rely on statistical evidence instead of relying on anecdotes, which is pretty much what people were relying on. If someone got sick and you drained some of their blood and then they got better, that was believed to be because of the bloodletting in many cases. Actually, probably those people just would have gotten better on their own. The bloodletting may not have been helping them at all. But it's a kind of classic case of what we call confirmation bias, where because you're expecting a treatment to work, when a person gets better, you ascribe the recovery to the treatment.
Bizarrely, bloodletting is still happening now. Where?
Definitely in India, and on my blog at National Geographic, you can see a video of people in Delhi, India, who are at a bloodletting clinic. This is run by bloodletters who are not medical doctors. It's an outdoor, open-air clinic, and they have generations of bloodletters who have developed skill at basically creating small cuts in people's hands and feet and allowing a certain amount of blood to drain out. And they sell this service as a cure for everything from arthritis to cancer.
Bloodletting, it sounds like a medieval treatment for balancing the bad humors in the blood. Well, it's still happening. At least it is in India. And Erika Engelhaupt, the online science editor for National Geographic, wrote about the method that is still being used to treat everything from arthritis to cancer. So what is the rationale? What is the logic behind letting blood out to cure?
You know, there's a certain simple appeal to the idea that if you're sick, you might have something wrong with your blood. You might have, in some sense, bad blood that you want to let out and then allow your body to make new blood. There's a certain logical appeal to that. That's the general idea around the world, is that there's something wrong with the blood, and by letting it out, you're going to let the bad things out and allow your body to heal itself by making new clean blood, essentially.
You actually came across a couple of studies about the technique. Does bloodletting ever actually work as a cure?
Well, it does not tend to work for the main types of infections and illnesses that people claim it should work for. However, there are certain incidents or certain characteristics that a person may have in their blood in which bloodletting may work. Again, I want to be very careful in describing this, because I'm not saying that bloodletting is a cure-all. In particular cases where someone has, for example, too much iron in the blood or an abnormally high count of red blood cells, in those cases, doctors still today may remove some of the volume of blood. That's to reduce that iron level or to reduce that overage of red blood cells. And in some cases, those conditions might be found in people with certain conditions such as diabetes. There have been a few small studies looking at whether in certain diabetics who have high iron levels, whether bloodletting might be a good treatment for them. And there may be some indication there. But again, those are preliminary studies and really are relating to particular cases, not the widespread cases of arthritis or cancer or infection that a lot of people have been using bloodletting for centuries.
Yeah, and they're certainly not screening for that at the open-air clinic in New Delhi, right?
No, and of course there are risks to bloodletting as well. The people that you see in this video, for example, you worry about the risk of infection. Also, letting too much blood can put people at risk of anemia, and even taken to the extreme can be a cause of death if you lose too much blood too quickly. So that's really a danger. Also, you're thinking about people who are already sick and you're removing some of their blood. When you're sick, you really need your blood. Your blood is not only carrying oxygen to all of the cells of your body, it's also carrying white blood cells, antibodies. It's carrying things you need, especially when you're sick.
But people in the video swear that they've tried absolutely everything for arthritis or other ailments, and bloodletting has cured them. So is this the placebo effect at work?
It's quite likely. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, and I can't diagnose what's wrong with these particular people and why they feel better. But the placebo effect is certainly very powerful, and it even can be a real effect. Sometimes people genuinely do see improvements just through placebo effect. But again, you want to be careful about buying into something where there are real risks, and there are real risks associated with removing blood.
Well, do you think there are differences between this and other health fads with debatable results, be it, you know, cleanses, extreme diets, saunas to get rid of the flu, for example?
Yes, I think there's a common logic there. When we're sick, when we feel badly, we think there's something wrong inside of me. There's something bad that needs to be removed, some kind of toxin or impurity. And that's a common theme in a lot of the treatments that you mentioned. People believe in them because it has this logical appeal that if you could only get these toxins out of your body, you would get better. In many cases, the problem is that you're actually just not getting rid of these supposed toxins that you think you're getting rid of. For example, let's say you have a wound in your leg that's infected, and you become sick with that infection. You have a fever. Draining your blood from the rest of your body is not going to really get rid of most of the bacteria that are causing that infection in your leg. But it is going to potentially give you anemia and be getting rid of some of those components in your blood that you do need in order to fight off infection.
Well, Erica, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Erika Engelhaupt. She's online science editor for National Geographic, where her blog entry, "Bloodletting is Still Happening Despite Centuries of Harm," appeared. It's filed under the Gory Details tab, and there is a video that accompanies it, and we're going to say that definitely qualifies. You can find both the video and the article. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear, see, and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please do rate it in iTunes. It'll help others find it. And as we know, the best surprises, stories, and ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.